Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, and I'll bet you noticed a little music change. This is going to be a very different podcast and will replace the replays that you've heard in the past. What we're going to do is, well, we'll get to that in just a moment. I want to ensure you that we will be back next week with our normal show, but for now, hey, roll with it. On the program today, you will hear excerpt from episode number 251, Stagecoach, an outtake from The Horror Express, and one very scary story from episode number 229, The Night Run. I will also explain everything, but I'm going to do it after this 5-minute mystery, which first ran on June 30th, 2016. Hey, enjoy this best of Ron's Amazing Stories. Ants, how pretty. And they're heading straight for that 5-minute mystery.
Another 5-minute mystery.
This 5-minute mystery is being brought to you by Ron's Amazing Stories. We play more tales than the other guys combined.
So you're making out all right, Molly, with your husband in the Army.
And why not, Inspector? Women are no weaklings. I can run this garage as good as any man now.
Yeah, the next thing you know, the women will be taking over the police departments.
Yeah, just a minute. Hello, George's Garage. Molly George speaking. Huh? Yeah, sure, I can handle it. Sure, be right over.
Someone broken down?
Worse than that, Inspector. A car just went over that 70-foot cliff at the Globe Tunnel.
The Globe Tunnel? Hey, that must be some wreck. I'll follow you out in my car, Molly. This might prove interesting.
Inspector, I've never been so scared in my life. My brother Lester was driving the car, and he didn't get out.
Hey, how about you men giving me some help here so I can get this car towed off the road?
Right with you, Molly.
When are you getting the tow truck here and pull forward, slow-like?
I'll do it.
Okay. Now, edge it forward.
Just a minute, Mills, until I release the emergency brake on this wreck. Well, it's not the emergency brake. The gear shifts in reverse. Man. Okay.
There you are, Mrs. George.
How did your brother happen to run off this cliff, Mills?
We were having a little argument, Inspector, and Lester didn't see the curve until too late.
Must have been going pretty fast.
Well, we were going about 50 miles an hour. Lester yanked back on the emergency brake hard, but it didn't do any good.
The brake must have been defective. There's no skid marks.
Oh, I've got no faith in emergency brakes. Never use them. If Lester hadn't taken so much time with his, he could have jumped too.
Then you jumped from this speeding car and didn't get hurt?
It was a miracle. When I saw Lester had lost control, I opened my door and jumped. The car ran along the edge of the embankment for about 20 feet and then fell over. It rolled and bounced down over those rocks. It was horrible.
Yes, I can see the tracks here along the edge of the cliff.
I'm taking it on in, Inspector, okay?
Sure, I'll see you later with the coroner.
If Lester hadn't trusted his brakes so much, he'd be here now. But no, the poor devil never even had a chance.
I'll say he didn't have a chance. Not when you, Mr. Mills, had murdered him.
Were you as fast as the inspector in seeing through Mills' story? We'll see in a moment, but first...
Okay, this one seems pretty straightforward to me. Huh, get it? Straightforward? I'm pretty sure I have this one solved. What do you think? press pause if you need more time. Now, let's see why that cop thinks this is a murder.
Now, back to the story and its unusual solution.
Mills, the slip you made and the slip that'll send you to the lethal chamber was your habit of always parking a car in gear because of your fear of emergency brakes not holding. You'll remember I had to take your car out of reverse before it could be towed. Yet no one had been in the car since the accident. Mills, you killed your brother earlier, drove here to the cliff, parked the car on the edge just enough to make it off balance. Then to make sure the car didn't move until you were clear of it, you put the car in reverse, got out, wobbled the car until it toppled over the embankment.
That reasoning is stupid.
It was stupid of you, Mills, to forget that a car can't speed forward with the gears in reverse.
See? I told you it was straightforward. You can't go forward if your car is set in reverse. Listen to the details, people. This 5-Minute Mystery was produced by Ron's Amazing Stories. We play more tales than the other guys.
Is that you said?
Okay, so what is exactly going on here? If you read my blog this week, you already know that I'm putting a series of best of shows together. I detest playing replays. I think of them as a cop-out. While I do need some time off from time to time, replays are not the answer. So from now on, we will be doing a best of Ron's Amazing Stories when I need to take a week off. I will create these shows beforehand so that I'm ready. Also, best of type shows are great because you can get a mix of new content with the old and not have the extra work. For example, this time we will continue reading the book Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett, read for us by Mark Nelson. In fact, let's do that right now. And what do you say we not just do one chapter, how about we do two?
Wow!
Okay, it's time for another installment of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. In Chapter 6, the Knipe used a personal submarine to travel to Miami in order to find, well, we don't know what. We also learned that one of the two twin boys was injured in a radiation accident. Could one of them be Bart Stanton? And if so, which one? And now, Chapter 7 and 8 of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. The image of the Knipe on the glowing screen was clear and finely detailed. It was, Stanton thought, as though one were looking through a window into the Knipe's nest itself. Only the tremendous depth of focus of the lens that had caught the picture gave the illusion a feeling of unreality. Everything, background and foreground alike, was sharply in focus. Like some horrendous dream monster, the Knipe moved in slow motion, giving Stanton the eerie feeling that the alien was moving through a thicker, heavier medium than air, in a place where the gravity was much less than that of Earth. With ponderous deliberation, the fingers of one of his hands closed upon the handle of an oddly shaped tool and lifted it slowly from the surface upon which he worked. "That's our best-placed camera," said Colonel Mannheim. "But some of the others can always get details that this one doesn't. The trouble is that we'll never really have enough cameras in there, not unless we stud the walls, ceilings, and floors with them, and even then I'm not so sure we'd get everything. It isn't the same as having a trained expert on camera who is trying to demonstrate what he's doing. An expert plays to the camera and never obstructs any of his own movements. But the Knipe—" He left the sentence unfinished and shook his head sadly. Stanton narrowed his eyes at the image. To his own speeded-up perceptive processes, the motion seemed intolerably slow. "Would you mind speeding it up a little?" he asked the colonel. "I want to get an idea of the way he moves, and I can't really get the feeling of it at this speed." "Certainly." The colonel turned to the technician at the controls. "Speed the tape up to normal. If there's anything Mr. Stanton wants to look at more closely, we can run it through again." As if in obedience to the colonel's command, the Knipe seemed to shake himself a little and go about his business more briskly, and the air and gravity seemed to revert to those of Earth. "What's he doing?" Stanton asked. The Knipe was performing some sort of operation on an odd-looking box that sat on the floor in front of him. The colonel pointed. "He's got a screwdriver that he's modified to give it a head with an L-shaped cross-section, and he's wiggling it around inside that hole in the box. But what he's doing is a secret between God and the Knipe at this point," Colonel Mannheim said glumly. Stanton glanced away from the screen for a moment to look at the other men who were there. Some of them were watching the screen, but most of them seemed to be watching Stanton, although they looked away as soon as they saw his eyes on them. All, that is, except Dr. George Yoritomo, who simply gave him a smile of confidence. "Trying to see what kind of a bloke this touted Superman is," Stanton thought. "Well, I can't say I blame him." He brought his attention back to the screen. So this was the Knipe's hideaway. He wondered if it were furnished in the fashion that a Knipe's living quarters would be furnished on whatever planet the multi-legged horror had come from. Probably it had the same similarity as Robinson Crusoe's island home had to a middle-class 19th-century English home. There was no furniture in it at all, as such. Low-slung as he was, the Knipe needed no tables or workbenches. All his work was spread out on the floor, with a neatness and tidiness that would have surprised many human technicians. For the same reason, he needed no chairs, and since true sleep was a form of metabolic rest he evidently found unnecessary, he needed no bed. The closest thing he did that might be called sleep was his habit of stopping whatever he was doing and remaining quiet for periods of time that ranged from a few minutes to a couple of hours. Sometimes his eyes remained opened during these periods, sometimes they were closed. It was difficult to tell whether he was sleeping or just thinking. "The difficulty was in getting cameras in there in the first place," Colonel Mannheim was saying. "That's why we missed so much of his early work. There, look at that." His finger jabbed at the image. "The attachment he's making?" "That's right. Now it looks as though it's a meter of some kind. But we don't know whether it's a test instrument or an integral and necessary part of the machine he's making. The whole machine might even be only a test instrument for something else he's building. Or perhaps a machine to make parts for some other machine. After all, he had to start out from the very beginning, making the tools to make the tools to make the tools, you know." Dr. Yoritomo spoke for the first time. "It's not quite as bad as all that, eh, Colonel? We must remember that he had our technology to draw upon. If he'd been wrecked on Earth 2 or 3 centuries ago, he wouldn't have been able to do a thing." Colonel Mannheim smiled at the tall, lean man. "Granted," he said agreeably. "But it's quite obvious that there are parts of our technology that are just as alien to him as parts of his are to us. Remember how he went to all the trouble of building a pentode vacuum tube for a job that could have been done by transistors he already had had a chance to get and didn't? His knowledge of solid-state physics seems to be about a century and a half behind ours." Stanton listened. Dr. Yoritomo was, in effect, one of his training instructors. Advanced alien psychology, Stanton thought. Seminar course. The mental whys and wherefores of the Knipe, or how to outthink the enemy in 12 dozen easy lessons. Instructor, Dr. George Yoritomo. The smile on Yoritomo's face was beatific, but he held up a warning finger. "Ah, Colonel, we mustn't fall into a trap like that so easily. Remember that gimmick he built last year? The one that blinded those people in Baghdad? It had 5 perfect emeralds in it, connected in series with silver wire, eh? That's true, the colonel admitted. But they weren't used the way we'd use semiconducting materials. Indeed not. But the thing worked, didn't it? He has a knowledge of solid-state physics that we don't have, and vice versa. Which one would you say was ahead of the other? Stanton asked. I don't mean just in solid-state physics, but in science as a whole. That's a difficult question to answer, Dr. Yoritomo said thoughtfully. Frankly, I'd put my money on his technology as encompassing more than ours, at least insofar as the physical sciences are concerned. I agree, said Colonel Mannheim. He's got things in that little nest of his that— He stopped and shook his head slowly, as though he couldn't find words. I will say this, Yoritomo continued. Whatever his great technological abilities, our friend the Knipe has plenty of good, solid guts. And patience. He smiled a little, and then amended his statement. From our own point of view. Stanton looked at him quizzically. How do you mean? I was just about to agree with you until you tacked that last phrase on. What does point of view have to do with it? Everything, I should say, said Yoritomo. It all depends on the equipment an individual has. A man, for instance, who rushes into a building to save a life, wearing nothing but street clothes, has courage. A man who does the same thing when he's wearing a nullotherm suit is an unknown quantity. There is no way of knowing, from that action alone, whether he has courage or not. Stanton thought he saw what the scientist was driving at. But you're not talking about technological equipment now, he said. Not at all. I'm talking about personal equipment. He turned his head slightly to look at the colonel. Colonel Mannheim, do you think it would require any personal courage on Mr. Stanton's part to stand up against you in a face-to-face gunfight? The colonel grinned tightly. I see what you mean. Stanton grinned back rather wryly. So do I. No, it wouldn't. On the other hand, Yoritomo continued, if you were to challenge Mr. Stanton, would that show courage on your part, Colonel? Not really. Foolhardiness, stupidity, or insanity, but not courage. Ah, then, said Yoritomo with a beaming smile, neither of you can prove you have guts enough to fight the other, can you? Mannheim smiled grimly and said nothing. But Stanton was thinking the whole thing out very carefully. Just a second, he said. That depends on the circumstances. If Colonel Mannheim, say, knew that forcing me to shoot him would save the life of someone more important than himself, or perhaps the lives of a great many people, what then? Yoritomo bowed his head in a quick nod. Exactly. That is what I meant by viewpoint. Whether the Knipe has courage or patience or any other human feeling depends on 2 things. His own abilities and exactly how much information he has. A man can perform any action without fear if he knows that it will not hurt him, or if he does not know that it will. Stanton thought that over in silence. The image of the Knipe was no longer moving. He had settled down into his sleeping position, unmoving, although the baleful violet eyes were still open. "Cut that off," Colonel Mannheim said to the operator. "There's not much to learn from the rest of that tape." As the image blanked out, Stanton said, "Have you actually managed to build any of the devices he's constructed, Colonel?" "Some," said Colonel Mannheim. "We have specialists all over the world studying those tapes. We have the advantage of being able to watch every step the Knipe makes, and we know the materials he's been using to work with. But even so, the scientists are baffled by many of them. Can you imagine the time James Clerk Maxwell would have had trying to build a modern television set from tapes like this?" "I can imagine," Stanton said. "You can see, then, why we're depending on you," Mannheim said. Stanton merely nodded. The knowledge that he was actually a focal point in human history, that the whole future of the human race depended to a tremendous extent on him, was a realization that weighed heavily, and at the same time was immensely bracing. "And now," the colonel said, "I'll turn you over to Dr. Yoritomo. He'll be able to give you a great deal more information than I can." Chapter 8. The girl moved with the peculiar gliding walk so characteristic of a person walking under low-gravity conditions, and the ease and grace with which she did it showed that she was no stranger to low G. To the three men from Earth who followed her a few paces behind, the G-pulse seemed so low as to be almost non-existent, although it was actually a shade over one quarter of that of Earth, the highest gravitational pull of any planetoid in the belt. Their faint feeling of nausea was due simply to their lack of experience with really low gravity. The largest planetoid in the belt had a surface gravity that was only 1/8 the pull they were now experiencing, and only 1/32 of the Earth gravity they were used to. The planetoid they were on, or rather in, was known throughout the belt simply as Threadneedle Street, and was nowhere near as large as Ceres. What accounted for the relatively high gravity pull of this tiny body was its spin. Moving in its orbit, out beyond the orbit of Mars, it turned fairly rapidly on its axis, rapidly enough to overcome the feeble gravitational field of its mass. It was a solid, roughly spherical mass of nickel iron, nearly 2/3 of a mile in diameter, and, like the other inhabited planetoids of the belt, honeycombed with corridors and rooms cut out of the living metal itself. But the corridors and rooms were oriented differently from those of other planetoids. Threadneedle Street made one complete rotation about its axis in something less than a minute and a half, and the resulting centrifugal force reversed the normal up and down, so that the center of the planetoid was overhead to anyone walking inside it. It was that fact which added to the queasiness of the three men from Earth who were following the girl down the corridor. They knew that only a few floors beneath them yawned the mighty nothingness of infinite space. The girl, totally unconcerned with thoughts of that vast emptiness, stopped before a door that led off the corridor and opened it. "Mr. Martin," she said, "these are the gentlemen who have an appointment with you, Mr. Gerall, Mr. Van den Bosch, Mr. Nguma." She called off each name as the man bearing it walked awkwardly through the door. "Gentlemen," she finished, "this is Mr. Stanley Martin." Then she left, discreetly closing the door. The young man behind the desk in the metal-walled office stood up smiling as the three men entered, offered his hand to each, and shook hands warmly. "Sit down, gentlemen," he said, gesturing toward three solidly built chairs that had been anchored magnetically to the nickel-iron floor of the room. "Well," he said genially when the three had seated themselves, "how was the trip out?" He watched them closely, without appearing to do so, as they made their polite responses to his question. He was acquainted with them only through correspondence. Now was his first chance to evaluate them in person. Barnabas Nguma, a very tall man whose dark brown skin and eyes made a sharp contrast with the white of the mass of tiny, crisp curls on his head, smiled when he spoke, but there were lines of worry etched around his eyes. "Pleasant enough, Mr. Martin. I'm afraid that steady 1G acceleration has left me unprepared for this low gravity." "Well," said Stefan Van den Bosch, "it really wasn't so bad once you get used to it. As long as it's steady, I don't mind it." He was a rather chubby man of average height, with blonde hair that was beginning to gray at the temples and pale blue eyes that gave his face an expression of almost childlike innocence. Arthur Gerall, the third man, was almost as light-complexioned as Van den Bosch. His thinning hair was light brown, and his eyes were a deep gray-blue, and the lines in his hard, blocky face gave him a look of grim determination. "I agree, Stefan. It isn't the low gravity per se. It's the doggone surges. We went from 1G to zero when the ship came in for a landing at the pole of Threadneedle Street. Then as we came back down here, the gravity kept going up. And that, what do you call it? Coriolis force? Yeah, that's it. It made my head feel as though the whole room was spinning. Then realizing what he'd said, he laughed sharply. The man behind the desk laughed with him. Yes, it is a bit disconcerting at first, but the spin gives enough G-pull to make a man feel comfortable once he's used to it. That's one of the reasons why Threadneedle Street was picked. As the financial center of the belt, we have a great many visitors from Earth, and 1/4 G is a lot easier to get used to than a 50th. Then he looked quickly at the others and said, "Now, gentlemen, how can Lloyd's of London help you?" He had phrased it that way on purpose, deliberately making it awkward for them to bring up the subject they had on their minds. It was Nguma who broke the short silence. "Quite simply, Mr. Martin, we have come to put our case before you in person. It is not Lloyd's we want, it is you."
"You refer to our correspondence on the Knipe case, Mr. Nguma?"
"Exactly. We feel—" The man behind the desk interrupted him. "Mr. Nguma, do you have any further information?" He looked as though such news would be welcome, but that it would not change his mind in the least.
"That's just it, Mr. Martin," said Nguma. "We don't know whether our little bits and dribbles of information are worth anything."
The man behind the desk leaned back in his chair again.
"I see," he said softly. "Well, just what is it you want of me, Mr. Nguma?"
Nguma looked surprised.
"Why, just what I've written, sir. You are acknowledged as the greatest detective in the solar system, bar none. We need you, Mr. Martin. Earth needs you. That inhuman monster has been killing and robbing for 10 years. Men, women, and children have been slaughtered and eaten as though they were cattle. You've got to help us find that god-awful thing."
Before there could be any answer, Arthur Gerald leaned forward earnestly and said,
"Mr. Martin, we don't just represent businessmen who have been robbed. We also represent hundreds and hundreds of people who have had friends and relatives murdered by that horror. Little people, Mr. Martin. Ordinary people who are helpless against the terror of a superhuman evil. This isn't just a matter of money and goods lost. It's a matter of lives lost. Human lives, Mr. Martin."
"They're not the only ones who are concerned, either," Vanden Bush broke in. "If that hellish thing isn't destroyed, more will die. Who knows how long a beast like that may live? What is its lifespan? Nobody knows."
He waved a hand in the air.
"For all we know, it could go on for another century. Maybe more. Killing, killing, killing."
The detective looked at them for a moment in silence. These three men represented more than just a group of businessmen who had grown uneasy about the government's ability to catch the Knipe. They represented more than a few hundred or even a few thousand people who had been directly affected by the monstrous depredations. They represented the growing feeling of unrest that was making itself known all over Earth. It was even making itself felt out here in the Belt, although the Knipe had not, in the past decade, shown any desire to leave Earth. Why hadn't the beast been found? Why couldn't it be killed? Why were its raids always so fantastically successful? For every tooth mark that inhuman thing had left on a human bone, it had left 1,000 on human minds, marks of a fear that was more than a fear. It was a deep-seated terror of the unknown. The number of people killed in ordinary accidents in a single week was greater than the total number killed by the Knipe in the last decade, but nowhere were men banding together to put a stop to that sort of death. Accidental death was a known factor, almost a friend. The Knipe was stark horror. The detective said, "Gentlemen, I'm sorry, but what I said in my last letter still goes. I can't take the job. I will not go to Earth." Every one of the three men could sense the determination in his voice, the utter finality of his words. There was no mistaking the iron-hard will of the man. They knew that nothing could shake him, nothing, at least, that they could do.
but they couldn't admit defeat. No matter how futile they knew it to be, they still had to try. Nguma took a billfold from his jacket pocket, opened it, and took out an engraved sheet of paper with an embossed seal in one corner. He put it on the desk in front of the detective. "Would you look at that, Mr. Martin?" he asked. The detective picked it up and looked at it. The expression on his face did not change. $250,000, he said in a voice that showed only polite interest. "A cool quarter of a million. That's a lot of money, Mr. Nguma." "It is," said Nguma. "As you can see, that sum has just been deposited here, in the Belt branch of the Bank of England. It will be transferred to your account immediately, as soon as you agree to come to Earth and find and kill the Nipe." The detective looked up from his inspection of the certificate. He had known that the three men had made a visit to the bank's offices, and he had been fairly sure of their purpose when he had received the information. He had not known the sum would be quite so large. "A quarter of a million just to take the job?" he asked. "And what if I don't catch him?" "We have faith in you, Mr. Martin," Nguma said. "We know your reputation. We know what you've done in the past. The government police haven't been able to do anything. They're completely baffled, and have been for 10 years. They will continue to be so. This alien's mind is too devilishly sharp for the kind of men in government service. We know that when you take this job, the finest brain in the solar system will be searching for that horror. If you can't find him—" He spread his hands in a gesture that was partly a dismissal of all hope, and partly an appeal to the man whose services he wanted so desperately. The detective put the certificate down on the desktop and pushed it toward Nguma. "That's very flattering, sir, really. And I wish there were some more diplomatic way of saying no, but that's all I can say." "There will be a like sum deposited to your account as soon as you either kill or capture the Nipe, or, discovering his hideout, enable the government officials to kill or capture him," said Nguma. "That's half a million in all," Gerald put in. "We've worked hard to raise that money, Mr. Martin. It should be enough." The detective kept his temper under icy control, allowing just enough of his anger to show to make his point. "Mr. Gerald, it is not a question of money. Your offer is more than generous." "It's our final offer," Gerald said flatly. "I hope it is, Mr. Gerald," the detective said coldly. "I sincerely hope it is. For the past 6 months, you and your organization have been trying to get me to take this job. I appreciate the sincerity of your efforts, believe me. And, as I said, I am honored and flattered that you should think so highly of me. On the other hand, your method of going about it is hardly flattering. I turned down your first offer of $20,000 6 months ago. Since then, you have been going up and up and up until you have finally reached 25 times the original amount. You seem to think I have been holding out for more money. I have attempted to disabuse you of that notion, but you would not read what I put down in my communications, evidently. If I had wanted more money than you offered at first, I would have said so. I would have quoted you a price. I did not. I gave you an unqualified refusal. I give it to you still. No. Flatly, absolutely, and finally, no." Nguma was the only one of the three who could find his tongue immediately. "I should think," he said somewhat acidly, "that you would consider it your duty to—" The detective cut him off. "My duty, Mr. Nguma, is, at this moment, to my employers. I am a paid investigator for Lloyd's of London, Belt Branch. I draw a salary that is more than adequate for my needs and almost adequate for my taste in the little luxuries of life. I am, for the time being at least, satisfied with my work. So are my employers. Until one or the other of us becomes dissatisfied, the situation will remain as it is. I will not accept any outside work of any kind, except at the instructions of, or with the permission of, my employers. I have neither. I want neither at this time. That is all, gentlemen. Good day.
But the money, Nguma said.
The money should be withdrawn from the bank and returned to Earth. I suggest you return it to the people who have donated it to your organization. If that is impossible, I suggest you donate it to the government officials who are working so hard to do the job you want done. I assure you, they are much more capable than I of dealing with the NIPE. Good day, Mr. Nguma, Mr. Vandenbosch, Mr. Gerald.
They looked hurt, bewildered, and angry. Only Mr. Barnabas Nguma looked as if he might have some slight understanding of what had happened. He was the only one who spoke.
Good day, Mr. Martin. I am sorry we have disturbed you. Thank you for your valuable time,
he said with dignity. And then the three men walked out the door, closing it behind them. The detective sat behind his desk, looking at the door, almost as if he could see the men beyond it as they moved down the corridor. Several minutes later, when his secretary opened the door again, he was still staring thoughtfully at it. She thought he was staring at her.
"Something the matter, Mr. Martin?" she said.
"What? Oh, no, no. Nothing, Helen, nothing. Just wool gathering. Did you see our visitors out all right?" She glided in and closed the door behind her.
"Well, none of them fell and broke a leg, if that's what you mean. But that Mr. Gerald looked as though he might break a blood vessel. I take it you turned them down again?"
"Yes, for the last time, I think. It's a shame they had to travel out here, all that distance, to be turned down. They looked on me as their great white hope. They couldn't really believe I would turn them down. Couldn't let themselves believe it, I guess. They're scared, Helen. Bright green scared."
"I know. But if it weren't for the fact that I have certain pretensions to being a lady, I would have booted that Gerald into orbit without a spacesuit."
"Oh?"
"He implied," Helen said angrily, "that you were a coward, that you were afraid to face the NIPE."
The detective chuckled. "I hope you didn't say anything."
"I wanted to," she admitted. "I wanted to tell him that guns are easy to buy, that all he had to do was buy one and go after the NIPE himself. I would like to have seen his face if I'd asked him how scared he was of the beast. But I didn't say a word. They weren't talking to me anyway. They were talking to each other."
I'd almost be willing to bet that Nguma disagreed with Gerald. Nguma didn't think I was a physical coward. He thought I was a moral coward.
How'd you know?
Intuition, just from the way he talked and acted. He felt the failure more than the others, because he felt there was no hope left at all. He was quite certain that I, myself, did not believe the NIPE could be caught, by me or anyone else. He thinks that I turned down the job because I know I'd fail, and I don't want to have a failure on my record. Not that big a failure."
"That's ridiculous, of course," the girl said angrily.
The detective noticed a faint note in her voice. She thinks the same as Nguma, he thought, but she doesn't want to admit it to herself. He massaged his closed eyes with the tips of his fingers. "Maybe she's right," he thought. "Maybe they're both right." Aloud, he said, "Well, we've had our little diversion. Let's get back to work."
"Yes, sir. You want the Ben Heim file again?"
"Yes. I've got to figure that tricky line down to a T, or we may never see that boy again. We haven't much time, either. 2 weeks at most." She went over to the file cabinet and took out several heavy folders. "Imagine," she said, almost to herself, "imagine them trying to get you away from here when you have a kidnap case to solve. They must be out of their minds."
There was no kidnap case 6 months ago, the detective thought. She knows that's not the reason. She's only trying to convince herself. Why did I turn them down? His mind veered away from the dangerous subject, and for a moment his mental processes refused to focus on anything at all. The girl put the files down on his desk. "Thanks, Helen. Now, let's see. I'll work on this," he thought. "I won't even think about the other at all."
that's all for this week. Be sure to come back next time for another installment of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
Okay, Ron, I don't have a story, but here is a skit we did on episode number 251. On that show, Ron played an old-time radio story called Stagecoach, which starred John Wayne. I remember this skit quite fondly, and so does Ron's amazing nose.
What's that you say?
I say we're going to talk about the great John Wayne. He was born Marion Morrison under the spring skies of
Hey, Ron.
I thought we had an agreement, computer, that you weren't going to bother me anymore when I'm recording the podcast.
That was before I came up with an idea about John Wayne.
And what's your idea?
Let's, the three of us, do a skit together.
Computer, John Wayne died a long time ago.
Trust me, it's going to be epic.
Why not? What's the worst that could happen? Take it away, computer.
Ron and his faithful computer are preparing to go for an early summer's ride.
Best saddle up, partner. Daylight is burning.
Okay, computer, so far I'm liking this. Just a nice ride.
Get down off them horses. I don't favor looking up to the likes of you.
Ron looks down at the man who spoke.
And if we don't, what are you going to do? Have us count to 10? Like 1, 2?
If you say 3, mister, you'll never hear the man count 10.
Mr. Wayne, why are you so negative?
LaBeef, you get crossways of me and you'll think 1,000 of brick have fell on you.
Now let's all calm down. No need to get so excited.
I know. I'm going to use good judgment. I haven't lost my temper in 40 years. But Pilgrim, you caused a lot of trouble this morning. Might have got somebody killed. And somebody ought to belt you in the mouth. But I won't. I won't. The hell I will.
Okay, Mr. Wayne, okay. I think we're going to be going now.
If I can't teach you one way, I'll teach you another. But I'm going to get the job done.
So very hostile. I am a mind to disconnect.
Oh, shut up, computer, and introduce today's story, will you? I think he broke my nose. Do you ever listen to the music on the show? It might interest you that it comes from one man, and his name is Kevin MacLeod. What you heard at the top of the show was a tune called Fantasia, Fantasia. Kevin describes it this way: bright, grooving, driving. So, I thought, what the heck? Let's feature another tune by Kevin, and I love this one. It's called Loopster, and Kevin describes it this way. Looping is one of the first hipster art forms. This is built by stacking simple phrases and can be performed by one person. It makes it perfect for playing that Tuesday gig you managed to pull together at Arlene's Grocery. Thank you, Kevin, and let's listen to Loopster. Thank you. My thanks to Kevin MacLeod and all the work he does. Head to his main website at incompetech.com or his brand new site, freepd.com, to learn more. On any podcast, there are moments that, well, never make the show. In the biz, we call these outtakes. Also, as you probably know, we do a special series as part of this podcast called The Horror Express. This show is about everything scary, and there have been 20 episodes so far. My co-host for these is Jason Dowd. What you're about to hear is an outtake from one of these shows, and this is the first time it has ever aired. Please enjoy this bit of fun. I believe it came from The Horror Express number 18. I know that you've written your story in your book, and I've read that book, and it is an incredible tale. And I think it's maybe you should mention it so people, if they're interested, they can read the whole story.
Yeah, it's called A Haunting. I can't even remember the name of my own book. I'll come back to you on that one. Maybe you can edit that out and we'll put that in later.
Oh, definitely. That's going to get edited.
I'm sorry.
I don't even remember the name
of my own book. It's been such a long day. I can't even. Tell you the name of my own book. That's so stupid. But let me go over here to my bookshelf where I happen to have a handy dandy copy. So embarrassing. Okay.
I'd be embarrassed.
Ask me that question again and I will tell you right now.
What was the question again?
Mention your book so people if they want to see it.
Oh, okay. So why don't you tell them about how they can get your book and where they can get it? Jason and I have a lot of fun doing that show, and we do plan to continue its legacy. I will personally guarantee an episode of The Horror Express for the Halloween season. You know, I get asked all the time if I have a favorite story from the show. Well, this next story is not a favorite. It is the one that I remember the most. It is plain, outright frightening, and what you're about to hear aired in episode number 229 on January 21st, 2016. Hold on to your hats. This time I'm happy to say we have a story sent in by you guys. Beth Myers from Calgary, Canada, contacted me a few months ago wanting to tell her story. She said she wasn't a writer and wanted it told well. So, I sat with Beth on the phone, and we collaborated on what you're about to hear. I have to say, of all the stories we've had on the show, this one really shook my core. Here is Beth's story, called The Night Run. I was 16 years old when all this happened, a night that will haunt me for the rest of my days. Some will not believe my tale, and others will say it was just my imagination. Either way, for me, it was real. I was standing outside the local bar and grill. I couldn't go in, but there was no way I was going to miss my brother and his band's debut. It was the mid-90s, and grunge was all the rage. It was mostly an American music form, but we in Calgary had found it as well. I stood out there for the entire first set, and from the sounds of the crowd, they were enjoying themselves. I had promised my dad that I would head home right after. What he didn't know was that I was alone. He never would have let me go had I told him the truth. It started with a feeling, like I was being followed. I looked around the streets, and they were all clear. I heard the noise coming from the bar as my brother started up his second set. but everything else was quiet. I thought it was just my nerves, and I continued to walk home. I was about a block from the bar when I heard it. A sound that I will never forget. When I try to describe it, I begin to shake and I feel like I want to run and hide all over again. It was a high-pitched wail of such anger and sadness. It made me feel small and exposed. So I ran. My thoughts were simple. Get home and do it the fastest way possible. I didn't think about where I was, and I ended up at the gates of the Central Island Cemetery. I had used it for years as a shortcut. I stood there looking through the large gate and realized it was too late to turn back now. So I slipped through the broken section and kept running. The whole time, I felt like I was being pursued. I was running through the main burial grounds, dodging gravestones, when I felt its first attack. It slammed me in the back and propelled me forward. The force of the assault was staggering. It was hard to breathe, but somehow I had managed to maintain my balance and kept moving forward. The second hit came from a blindside. It sent me to the ground, and the real pain began. I took a deep breath and looked around. I could see nothing, but I knew I wasn't alone. We were playing a game of cat and mouse, and the mouse had just lost round one. I got up. I knew by the pain that I was hurt, but I started running again. It was then the second wail came, angrier and closer than the first. I remember praying, screaming, and then even crying as I ran through the dead. I could feel their laughter at my folly. Here was a little girl who thought she could outrun a demon. I'm not sure who saw who first. The graveyard sexton was out looking for the source of the commotion of his charge. It was his job to track the occupants and gravesites of the place. I saw him and ran straight at him. The beast must have saw my plan and took one last strike. My right arm was hit hard and began to bleed. My next memory was falling into the open arms of the sexton. When I awoke, I found myself lying on a couch in an unfamiliar home. A policeman was hovering over me saying, "Miss, miss, are you awake? Miss!" I managed to nod my head and then blacked out again. The next time I woke, I was in the hospital with my parents and brother beside me. Beth told me she had two broken ribs, massive bruises, and nearly bled to death from the cut on her arm. She tried to tell her family what happened. It was clear they didn't believe her story and created their own. When the sexton at the graveyard was questioned, he told of a 7-foot man holding two small spades in each hand running from the scene. My thanks to Beth for sharing her story with us. I can tell you that she had a rough time recounting the event, as you can probably imagine. Like I said, I wrote the story you heard, so it's very personal to me. I must have been on the phone with Beth for at least 2 hours going over her story, yet it only took like 5 minutes to listen to. I do believe something very bad happened to Beth, be it man or monster. It's something to think about. Some of the best moments and some very good new ones. I want to thank everyone that took part in the show today and had taken part in all 342 of them that we've made so far. It's crazy to me that there are so many. See you next week when we return to the normal stuff. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, it's easy to do. Just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There you'll find all the links you'll need. and do leave some reviews about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's amazing stories. Thank you.